Welcome to
Teachers
Talk Radio.
Thanks for downloading this episode from Teachers Talk Radio. You can find the full schedule and listen back to all our shows at ttradio.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Good evening and welcome this Friday evening to this late show on Teachers Talk Radio. We've got Emily hosting tonight and she'll be on with us shortly talking about direct and explicit instruction, which will be an interesting show. If you've missed any of Emily's previous shows, then do go and have a look back on the Teachers Talk Radio website where you can search for Emily directly and find any of her previous shows, because there's a lot of good ones to have a look through there. Just a reminder that tonight's show is sponsored by John Cat Educational. You can get 25% of your reading needs there with the special Teach Talk Radio code, which is JCTTR2324. So go have a look at what amazing books they've got over at johncateducational.co.uk and see what books they've got. So there's some really good ones as well, so have a little look. But we're in for a good one. We've got Emily here now. I'm excited for this one because I just find them both really interesting. So welcome and enjoy the show.
Thank you. Hello and welcome to Teacher Talk Radio, where we will explore explicit and direct instruction. I'm your host, Emily Fullerman Show, and today we have a special guest with us. I'm really excited about this. If you're listening now, live I should say, feel free to send in your questions or comments about today's topic. We'd love to hear from you. Remember, you can always reach us out on social media with your thoughts and questions about today's episode. So please do contribute you and pose your questions. As you've just heard, Teacher Talk Radio is delighted to partner with John Cat, and this show is brought to you in partnership with John Cat Educational Publishing, professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncatbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development and reading. Speaking of John Cat, I have been rereading the Research Ed Guide on Explicit and Direct Instruction, which is edited by Adam Boxer. Out of interest, what is your favourite from the Research Ed Guide? Please do share your favourite by joining in the conversation or just tweeting us. But anywho, let us get back to the Research Ed Guide on Explicit and Direct Instruction. I'm just going to quickly, before Zach comes on, I'm just going to quickly read an extract from the introduction of the book to kick off the show. And this was written by Adam Boxer. And it says, "A few years ago into my career, I came across the Sutton Trust What Makes Great Teaching. Within the report, the author summarized foundational and robust research findings that would best support teacher quality. One section was headed as ineffective practices, and true to its title, went on to list a number of teacher activities that were either unlikely to lead to improved learning or would actually harm its progress. Some of these I knew about already. I knew that learning styles were bunk, that lavish praise could be counterproductive, and that grouping students by ability was precarious at best. What I was not prepared for was the simple statement that an example of an ineffective practice was to allow learners to discover new ideas for themselves, with the authors arguing that enthusiasm, for discovery learning is not supported by research evidence, which broadly favours direct instruction. Although learners do need to build new understanding of what they already know, if teachers want them to learn new ideas, knowledge or methods, they need to teach them directly. He then goes on to say, I followed the report citation article which reviewed the evidence from the cognitive sciences regarding how minimal guidance during instruction was significantly less effective than fully guided teacher-led instruction. From there, I was slowly introduced to the arena of the cognitive sciences and stronger models of human thought and condition that I had previously used to satisfy the second teacher's standard. So from this, we can see that direct and explicit instruction seems to be the best way in order to increase outcomes amongst our students. Today, I'll be interviewing an expert in the field of instructional design, and I'm thrilled now to introduce our guest, Zach Groschel. So welcome, Zach. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I'm super excited to talk about this topic with you, Emily.
I'm so excited. Thank you so much for joining. Before we dive into our discussion, Zach, could you please introduce yourself to our listeners and tell us about your background?
Sure. Well, I am a primary teacher by training, and I taught grades 4 through 5, which for you is, well, I think, 1 year more than that. So maybe years 5 through 7 for 10 years. And oh, wow. Then I recently became an instructional coach full time, but I teach a little bit as well. I teach what we would call tier 2 and tier 3 interventions. So kids who are really at the really having a lot, you know, years behind their peers. I work with them in math and so on. But I'm an American teacher now turned sort of an instructional coach full time.
Oh, amazing. Amazing. And I'm really looking forward to our conversation today. Can you give us, you know, some context on why you think, you know, this topic is important and relevant?
Well, I think that great teaching is the most important thing that teachers need to be focusing on. There's so many things that divide teachers' time and give them a necessary workload. And really, if we get down to what is the nuts and bolts most important things that teachers need to be focused on, it's great curriculum, great behavior, and great instruction. So I hope here we can talk about what does it mean to have really good, you know, explicit direct instruction, you know, what that means and why it's so important for, why is it so important for our kids to have a large dosage of it?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. Before we get into the nuts and bolts of the questions, I do want to welcome in our listeners. So welcome Sam, Katajo, and Michelle, and a fellow Teacher Talk radio host, Tom. So welcome everyone. Remember, if you are listening live, feel free to send in your questions or your comments about today's topic. We'd absolutely love to hear from you. And remember, you can always reach us at our handles, our Twitter handles. So, Zach, can you just, you know, define what is direct and explicit instruction? And is there a difference between the two?
There's not really much of a difference. I would say maybe it's how people use the terms. I think a lot of times when people use lowercase di, direct instruction, they might mean the teacher is talking up at the front. Yeah. And that's sort of the generic term for teacher-led teaching. Explicit instruction, I think this is why I use the term explicit instruction more. I think it has a few more connotations that are closer to what the research would suggest is good teaching. And that means, you know, the explicit part is that the language is unambiguous, right? But yeah, all other components that are beyond modeling, beyond the explaining, that are explicit instruction, mainly the high volume of practice and review. How the teacher checks for understanding constantly using formative assessment, that the teacher also is designing the learning by working backwards from an objective. And so then in doing so, you break down the material into smaller steps, present small steps one at a time, which is consistent with what we know about cognitive load theory. And eventually you get students to be able to do something on their own independently that they otherwise couldn't have done without, you know, so much, you know, instructional support and assistance.
Oh, amazing. So where does, for example, project-based learning come into play? So do you think students have the opportunity to engage in project-based learning after they've been taught using DI, do you think?
Well,
small DI?
Yeah, it's a great question. I personally don't use the word project-based learning because when I talk about a project within an explicit teaching sequence, because I was trained and I started my career in project-based learning, and we were told very specifically that a project is not project-based learning. A project is a project. Project-based learning involves the students inquiring into a topic, finding the questions that they want to answer, going through an inquiry cycle, and eventually creating a product that they show to an audience of their choice, right? This is what I trained to do when it came to project-based learning. And the clue is in the name, the B, based. Everything is based in the project. Projects for me in an explicit teaching sequence are very important, but they happen at the end of the sequence. The teacher models the material, the teacher checks for understanding, the teacher makes sure that the students are making progress towards the goal. And maybe a project is used for application. It's used to sort of make generalizations, or maybe it's just made to, you know, broadcast the learning to a larger audience. But the learning is based in a classroom culture where the teacher leads the learning, and perhaps a project is the final exercise in that sequence.
So just basically what I'm hearing is it's used as an application or used as an independent practice task.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of people that really love projects might find that the projects that I would advocate for are much smaller, much shorter time frame, and much more targeted than perhaps the big projects where the student really is creating and crafting the entire project themselves.
Amazing. Thank you. I am a big fan of explicit and direct instruction. I've seen the benefits in my own practice and in terms of students' results. However, I do get, you know, some teachers thinking and having the misconception that if the teachers are doing all the work, and if, for example, the teacher is, you know, using these methods, does it make students over-reliant on the teacher? What would you say in terms of that? Does DI, so small DI, direct instruction and explicit instruction, does it strip students of their independence?
Well, I do not think that is the case, because what I would say is that the knowledge that you learn from being explicitly taught needs to be used. And when at first you are reliant on a teacher, just like if you had to try to figure something out yourself, you'd be reliant on a manual or a neighbor or YouTube video, right? At first you need to gain some learning from someone who knows more than you. And we understand that when it comes to coaching, right? Would you say that, right, these athletes are acceptable for them to play a pickup game of basketball down at the park because they spend all of their day with the close supervision of a coach? You'd say that's silly, right?
Yeah.
But when you first are acquiring knowledge, you're in that kind of acquisition stage of the instructional hierarchy. You do need to rely on a teacher to explain things to you. But it's that gradual release of responsibility that is kind of that's the full sequence right there, starting with a teacher, going into guided practice, ending with independent practice. That's what the teacher is setting the student up to be able to do. And I think that the success that the student experiences from that sequence is really what we could call independence. We've taught them to be independent by giving them the tools so that they can interact with their environment by themselves. They can work with a partner because they know a lot of stuff and they've gained a lot of skills from a teacher who knows how to set them up for that.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Zach, for that. I see that we've got more listeners. So we've got Teta Ed, GCSE Hish, Abern, hi, Sam Alterac, Kadajo again, and Michelle. Feel free, as I said before, to, you know, send in your questions or comments. We love having you, and I hope you're enjoying the show. Thanks, Zach, for that. I, for example, I've taught some classes that they just have a, you know, short attention span. So what advice would you give to teachers using this form of pedagogy to secure and maintain students' attention during direct and explicit instruction?
Well, the first thing you really want to do is focus in on setting the conditions for attention. How are you going to enter your students into your classroom? Are they going to just kind of pile in from a noisy hallway? Or is your school set up the hallways, or as you call them, the corridors? Have you set up the corridors to be calm and safe places where kids aren't bashing into each other and coming in and out of the bathrooms and vaping and getting on their phones and so on? Have you set up the space right beforehand, right? Well, we could say this is addressing the antecedents. Are you setting the students up successfully by keeping them quiet? And when they get into class, do they know what to do? Is there a predictable environment? Do they have all of their pens in the same location, their notebooks in the same location? The teacher has them all facing towards the source of information as opposed to facing away from it, or having half of the students facing away from the source of information. And then finally, as a teacher, you need to deliver instruction that is planned. It needs to be at a brisk pace, because people very quickly tune out of lessons where the pace sort of lags. The teachers figure out what they're teaching. And as you're sort of, if you're teaching at this brisk pace, you are cold calling constantly. The students know that they are going to be chosen to speak in class. So they're alert, they're ready. And we have things like whiteboards and choral response, where everyone needs to respond at the same time. In our school, we have a thing called PBIS. So that means that we give students positive merits, and we also give demerits or detention. So a lot of times we're just trying to give students a little, you know, a point or two here and there, so that they're making their best effort. And they know also that there's a line. If you're not paying attention, if you're deciding to opt out of the lesson, that there are consequences involved. So that's how I would address that question.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much. It sounds like, just listening to, you know, your advice in terms of that for explicit and direct instruction to be very effective, there's going to have to be a level of expertise and a level, I guess, of experience from the teacher side. Because if I had to do that in my really early days of teaching, I don't know if I would have been secure in terms of my delivery. And also, I guess it's predicated as well on subject knowledge. Your teacher's subject knowledge really needs to be strong in terms of what questions to pose and trying to secure that attention from students.
If you know your subject, right, you know, you can work, what we'd say in problem solving, you can work forwards, right? You know what is coming next. You know that the possible errors that students make, so you know how to address them beforehand. You sort of set up a situation where you're marching forward in a predictable order, and you're not going to fall into any traps along the way. But if you're new, your presentation is going to be disfluent. You're going to be trying to figure out what you're teaching as you're saying. Yeah. You're going to have to backtrack because the students are confused and so on.
That makes sense. So would you recommend an NQT or an ECT, we call it in the UK, so a beginner teacher, to script out their explanations as a result?
Well, I personally do that. I've heard every time I say that, everybody says that there's a crazy amount of things that they need to do, and that's the last thing on their minds. But doing it once in a while, like actually just writing down what you would say, the examples you're going to use, the non-examples, you end up being in a situation where you outsource all of your cognitive load to your plan, to your piece of paper, right? And you can look at your paper and go, okay, here's what I was going to do. I was going to hit these checkpoints. I don't need to think up these questions on the fly. And this is the definition I'm going to use for this term. I'm not going to make it up on the fly. So kind of having an outline, and if you really want to get deep into it because you think this is going to be particularly tricky, actually scripting what you would say. It's worked for me. It's worked for my mentees. I don't know why people seem to hate it so much, but I think it works.
Speaking of mentees, we've received some questions and a comment from our listeners. So I just want to read one. Michelle asked, have you read an expose of how teachers were mistrained by a college of education professors? Have you read that? That's her question. She said it's from a podcast called Sold a Story, how kids went so wrong.
So just in general, have I noticed that teachers that come into the profession are not trained very well? I mean, I'm thinking that's right. Yeah, well, I meet up with 5 to 10 mentees. I meet up actually with quite a bit more newly qualified teachers now because we have so much turnover at this school. But we get... You get teachers who come in who have a lot of ideas that I would associate with sort of romantic notion how to teach. They first come in and they put everybody into pods or groups, and they start immediately with some sort of group work task. They ask questions, lots of questions, trying to see what they know and want to draw out knowledge that the kids don't have. And through working with me, very, very quickly, we figure out in discussion that this isn't working. The kids are taking over the lesson. There's chaos. Maybe we should work towards the group work, or maybe we should trim down some of your expectations of how young adolescents actually interact in a classroom when they have all of this pressure to perform for their peers. Maybe we should instead set up a system where they're incentivized to pay attention, incentivized to do their best. And so we face everybody towards the front. We deliver a lesson that's very similar to I do, we do, you do. And immediately the student see the success in their grades and their test scores. Their parents see a change in their children because their classes are better organized. It's remarkable that these professors running these programs would tell all these new teachers all of these things that are sort of theoretical. Children should be allowed to discover and direct their own learning. And then they come in. It takes about 4 weeks sometimes for a teacher to come to me begging, how can I fix my class? It's a mess. Oh, I'll show you. It's called direct instruction.
Yeah. Oh, thank you for that. So would you suggest that in terms of seating plans, students should be in rows rather than groups?
Well, rows, but I'm an elementary teacher, so we work a lot of times on the carpet. But what does rows look like in the carpet? We put little dots on the carpet, and all of the kids have a number, and they sit on the dot in rows on the carpet. Or you can do horseshoes, where you have a big wide horseshoe that allows the teacher to kind of move about if you have enough space in your room. The whole point is they're facing forward. I do a lot of turn and talks, and I want quick, fast-paced turn and talks. I ask a question, turn to your partner and discuss. I want that to happen often. So I want them sitting next to an A and B partner the whole time. So these rows are actually table groups facing forward. The point is they're looking at the source of information. They're not looking at each other, but they can quickly turn and do a turn and talk at a moment's notice.
Perfect. Thank you. So Tetered Toad said that seating arrangements are incredibly important, so echoing what you said. And Sam Alcatrax said, expertise reversal effect explains teacher responsibility ought to be gradually removed. This is not at odds with DI. What do you have to say in regards to what Sam's just said?
Well, I know Sam because he's an absolute savage. What he's referring to is that a lot of people will say, well, I do use direct instruction and I also use inquiry and I use a mixture of the both. And I would say, well, I want to hear about how you set students up for success through a gradual release of responsibility. Do you give students a huge project, like I described in that my PBL rant earlier? Do you give them a big old task to work on in groups, and then you walk around and you try to address misconceptions through what you are now calling direct instruction? Or does the learning start by you breaking down something that's really hard into its components, and then you gradually...
Oh, okay. I think we've lost Zach there. But whilst he connects, I just wanted to mention that this show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational Publishing, developmental books and resources to help great teaching and learning schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading. You can use the code to purchase explicit and direct instruction, which is part of a research ed guide in the John Catt series. So we've got Zach back with us. Zach, are you back? I think I heard you.
Yeah, I'm back. I'm sorry. I don't know what happened.
I think it might be connection, but it's fine. Just a reminder to our audience, please feel free to send in your questions, or if you want to speak, please, you know, request to speak and pose your questions to Zach. He's, you know, he's studying instructional design, so he's got a lot of knowledge in regards to instructional design, explicit instruction, as well as direct instruction. So please feel free to pose, and welcome to our new listeners such as Lane, Dan, Adriana and Name. So welcome everyone, and Sir Jackson. Thank you, Zach. It's nice to have you back with us. My next question is, do you think direct instruction or explicit instruction goes hand in hand with group work? Or is there a way to mesh the two?
I don't think it necessarily goes hand in hand. I think group work is a tool. It's an activity, right? Yeah. And a lot of teaching is sort of activity setting. Well, today I'm going to do some form of group work. Tomorrow I'm going to do some sort of Kahoot. I'm going to do some technology. I'm just going to try to mix stuff up and fill the time. And so explicit instruction really means looking at what the goal is of what you want the students to learn, actually identifying the objective, like measurable behavior that you would use as like a proxy for them having learned it, and then working towards that. So if group work were to be used in an explicit instruction sequence, we'd have to figure out how would that add to the learning. Is it that this is something that students, if they talk to each other about it, maybe they can process it better, they can rehearse the information better? Is it that they all need to add something to each other's knowledge, like in the form of a jigsaw, right? But unfortunately, yeah, so much group work is just done for the sake of group work. Let's put them together, have them working in a group. And I ask, why couldn't they have done this individually? They would have gotten so much more done. And it was so loud in here, no one could focus. So it goes hand in hand. I would say group work is a tool that can be used in explicit instruction only, you know, to the extent that it actually serves a purpose in the learning journey.
I definitely agree with that. We've received a question from Michelle NYNC, and she said, what do you think of systematic phonics as a model of explicit instruction for literacy, phonology, orthography, don't know how to pronounce that word, sorry, morphology, syntax, semantics, pragmatics, and discourse? Reading comprehension depends on strong decodal skills. Do you agree?
Nice. So phonics is more about the content of what we're teaching, right? In reading, that has been the biggest focus in the past couple years. Someone mentioned Sold a Story, right? And out of that discussion has been it has been encouraged worldwide that teachers should teach phonics explicitly. I don't see why there's any form of content that is any different than phonics in that regard, right? So we know that the sounds of the code are arbitrary, right? We're just figuring out how the squiggles work on the page. But so much knowledge has a right and a wrong answer, or there's only a narrow range of answers that are possibly correct. And so a lot of times teachers will say, well, phonics and math facts we need to teach directly, but everything else we can have them explore. I don't understand why the information would compel us to do that. And I think the evidence in terms of cognitive load theory, in terms of Rosenstein's principles of instruction, all of the direct instruction research of the past 5 decades would suggest that breaking complex materials down into their components and teaching them works for all subjects, not just beginning reading.
Perfect. Thank you. Sam Altrak has said that group work might have motivational effects, but the cost is the reliability of our confidence, what our students know / can do on their own. Thank you for sharing, Zach.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
The BBC News channel and news website features an interview with a secondary head teacher 1 year on from an incident in his school which resulted in a lockdown. Head teacher Kieran Stapleton confronted a male who had entered the school building, telling office staff he had a gun. The man has since been detained indefinitely in a secure psychiatric hospital. Mr. Stapleton talks of confronting the man on the corridors while staff followed lockdown procedures, locking classrooms, pulling down blinds and asking pupils to hide under desks and remain calm and silent. Mr. Stapleton used the interview to highlight the issue of mental health and the importance of support for young people in order to avoid instances of violence. He also pointed to the bravery of staff and pupils and the way they responded to the lockdown that was not a drill. The business section of the BBC News site focuses on the impact the post office scandal has had on the children of sub-postmasters. A group set up to support those affected was organised by Katie Downey, whose father was made bankrupt trying to repay money after the Horizon system failed. Ms. Downey was 11 when the family moved to France, and she stopped talking for 2 years. She set up the group Lost Chances for the Children of Sub-Postmasters as a way to support those affected, but is also trying to gain compensation for the changed lives. The group has 40 members so far, and many talk of difficult home lives, bullying at school, and feelings of shame after parents were accused. Some also shared experiences of poor mental health, eating disorders, and panic attacks. The group wants members of the public and other groups and agencies to understand how such trauma can affect children and young people. This is so that they are no longer considered as too remote from the harms caused, simply because the harm was not directly inflicted upon them. The holy month of Ramadan began earlier this month, and many schools have made arrangements to support pupils and staff who are fasting. This is something that many schools have done for years, but this year, staff shortages have meant that some schools have had to modify their usual procedures. Schools report difficulties in supervising pupils who are fasting in spaces away from food and drink, as they struggle to find additional staff or enough cover for absent staff. One primary school in the east of England resorted to asking parents to take fasting pupils home for the lunch period due to significant staff shortages. Parents expressed frustration at the request, with some quoted by East England News as saying it was insensitive and ridiculous. Some did point out that the school has often been supportive in the past and that it is proud of its multicultural awareness. The school said it was working hard to find a solution to the issue, but could not compromise pupil safeguarding. Difficulties in recruitment, retention, and accessing supply staff are an ongoing challenge for many schools. The University of Cambridge is scrapping its state school targets for undergraduate admissions, according to the Telegraph newspaper. The university said it would take candidate schools into account when selecting students, but would no longer have a target for the share of state and private schools' pupils gaining places. Cambridge has been accused of discriminating against pupils from private schools amid a decline in offer rates at top independent schools. Vice Chancellor Deborah Prentice said there is no discrimination, but competition is fiercer as state school pupils have been increasingly encouraged to apply. The targets were originally introduced to increase the portion of state-educated undergraduates from 63.4% to 69.1% by 2024-25. The university has beaten its target, with 72.9% of new students in 2022-23 coming from state schools. Finally, a headteacher's letter to parents on the subject of poor quality school meals has gone viral. The letter was sent after issues with the school's catering provider, Chartwell's, led to complaints from pupils over quality and portion sizes. In the letter, the headteacher says he would be exceptionally unhappy if his own children were served the food, and asks, how difficult is it to bake a potato? Whilst the letter focuses on issues with food service, it has highlighted the problems schools face around private finance initiative contract management, funding issues, and the impact inflation has had on the food prices, which have left some companies struggling. Some commentators have also raised the issue of the impact poor quality meals can have on pupils who receive free school meals. It's not the first time Chartwell's has been in the news, as the issue of food quality was raised during the pandemic, when the company was accused of providing poor quality food parcels to families during school closures. Chartwell said it was working with the school to rectify issues and acknowledged that the service had fallen well below the high standards we demand. This has been your Teachers Talk Radio News with Jo Fox.
Welcome to Teachers Talk Radio.
Thank you for listening.
Thanks for downloading this episode from Teachers Talk Radio. You can find the full schedule and listen back to all our shows at ttradio.org. Enjoy the podcast.
You said you're a primary school teacher. How would you teach maths or maybe literacy? Could you take us through a typical lesson that you've done using direct or explicit instruction, just as a model for those that the pedagogy of it is not really cemented in their heads? Can you talk us through an example of how to do it in practice?
Well, sure. Right now, I'm teaching a group of students who are disadvantaged, underserved by our system. I'm teaching them column addition, right, where you have three digits on the top, three digits on the bottom. And eventually, you need to get it so that they can actually regroup numbers that equal more than 10 in each place, right? So if you need to basically carry the numbers or borrow the numbers, right? And what I would see in a lot of classrooms that doesn't use explicit instruction is either the teacher gives them a single model of how to do it and then gives them lots and lots of problems to solve, or maybe even worse, the teacher gives them lots of games and maybe has them make a poster on the floor with markers. Or they're essentially just not teaching them how to do the material. So, like, let's take you through how I teach column addition. The first thing they need to do is every day for 5-10 minutes, they need to rehearse their math facts. So we do 5 + 1 = 6, 5 + 2 = 7, and so on. And we rehearse them one by one. I only introduce into column addition the facts that I know they know to mastery, because I don't want them to be stuck trying to count on their fingers or trying to recall a fact. I want those to be effortless when they get to the column addition. Before that, I need to break down this even more. I need to make sure they can line up the digits correctly. You've seen a lot of students in elementary, they don't line up the digits correctly, and that's exactly where they go wrong in the procedure. So we practice that separate from actually adding in columns. And then we're going to start at the smallest columns. We're going to add one digit numbers first, then 2 and 1, and then 3 and 1, and then 3 and 2. Finally, we're going to be 3 and 3, but I haven't even introduced regrouping yet. I will finally introduce the concept of regrouping slowly, one step at a time, bit by bit. Maybe every day we introduce it so that at the end of the sequence, they can actually add three digit problems effortlessly without having to recall the facts, without having an issue with lining up the digits, without having an issue with regrouping. So that's, for me, that's what explicit instruction is. It's breaking it down far further than most people, I think, expect you need to.
Thank you. So it's almost like, would you say it's almost like scaffolding?
I think explicit instruction is synonymous with scaffolding in a lot of ways. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Adriana's just said, interesting. Thank you, Adriana. Feel free to join in the conversation, pose your questions, or join in live in terms of the discussion. So let us get on to explanations. I feel that explanations aren't really honed in enough when it comes to CPD. We get a CPD in terms of retrieval practice, CPD on feedback, CPD on classroom management and routines, various areas in terms of teaching. But I haven't ever in my career, and I've been teaching for close to 9 years now, received CPD in terms of honing and improving my explanation. So can you tell us what does good teacher explanations look like to use that?
Right. Well, I do myself. I've been doing presentations on explanations this year. So I'm sort of refining the same presentation over and over again, which is. But what I focus in on when I talk to teachers about explanation are some of the things we've mentioned. But I'll go into depth into a few that maybe are not really talked about as much. Mm-hmm. One of them is that language is very easy to be disfluent and hard to understand for students. And so I focus in on what research would call discontinuity, which is where there's these brief interruptions in the speech. I also talk about mazes and vagueness, the teachers using words like and ah, which I am having trouble with in this discussion,
omitting
my speech, right?
Yes, same. Yeah.
A lot of times teachers are simply not confident with their speech. And so they're sort of talking around in circles, and they call those mazes, but or they're going off on digressions. They want to tell these really interesting anecdotes, but they're sort of unrelated to the topic. And so if we can get really parsimonious and direct about our explanations, really just only saying the words that need to be said and keeping those words consistent. If you think maybe more of a behavioral perspective, a stimulus and response interactions, you really want the stimulus to become associated with the response you want. So constantly changing your wording at the beginning of introducing something can confuse students. So trying to say, right, this is a fraction, this is not a fraction. This is a denominator, this is not a denominator. Instead of kind of being more wordy and verbose with your explanations. Mm-hmm. Another area I talk about is that explanations are not the same as what we would see in a text. A text is just the words, but without interaction. A teaching explanation needs to be interactive. So very short bursts of unambiguous language, small step presentations that then are alternating with student responses. And so that what that compels us to do is we have to plan what we're going to say, but we also have to plan what they're going to say. We have to figure out what are the questions that I'm going to ask? What kind of responses am I going to elicit? And I'm going to be doing this like it's a tennis match, sort of a serve and return back and forth with my students. And then I talk a lot about storytelling, about using images, pairing images with explanations so that your explanation is concrete, has a permanent reference for students to look at. I talk about drawing, using dynamic drawing where you only add one thing at a time onto the canvas. Yeah. So there's so many areas to really talk about with teachers because it's so important to learn these things.
Perfect. Thank you. Sam's added to what you just said that teaching is cognitively overloading enough without having to generate an explanation on the spot. I definitely agree with that, especially if you're teaching. I'm a history teacher, and it's impossible to know everything to do with history. So there's various periods of history that I'm stronger in and various periods that I've got weak knowledge in. And those areas that I have weaker knowledge in, I find that I have to really think about my explanations. So, for example, at the moment, I'm teaching in Dubai, and I'm teaching a whole unit that I've never taught before. Although I've got some detail and some knowledge, I should say, on Thatcher's term as Prime Minister, my knowledge isn't as sound as the tutors, for example, especially teaching A-level. They have to have a certain depth in terms of their knowledge. So I'm often having to, for example, lean on ChatGPT to help me. How can I explain supply-side economics, for example, to 14-year-olds? Although they are 16, 17, I'm trying to pitch it to a 14-year-olds, especially because a large amount of them are EAL. So ChatGPT, just a tip for you listeners, is absolutely fantastic for helping you to script explanations, as well as finding metaphors and analogies to really make those explanations come alive. So that's just a teacher hack there, if anybody does want to use that.
I'll tell teachers to create it and then ask.
Hello? I think we've just lost you, Zach, so I'll just wait again for you to come back on, which gives us a great time to go back to our reminder that this show is brought to you in partnership with John Cat Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to help great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Do not miss out. Make sure you visit johncatbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading. And I definitely, as I have mentioned it again before, but it's such a good book that you could use the code for John Cat, and it's the explicit and direct instruction, which is part of the research ed guide. So I definitely recommend purchasing that. I think we've got Zach back.
Yeah. And Emily, can I build off what you said about the chat GPT thing for a second?
Yeah, of course.
I just think it's so, you can ask it to explain something, and then it's the prompts you do afterwards that are really important. So ask ChatGPT to maybe paint a more vivid picture to tell that in a story, right? And you start to see, use metaphors and analogies, and all of a sudden you start to see that plain explanation ends up, you know, having a bit more of a performative aspect, more beauty and feelings involved in it that can maybe make it a more immersive explanation. So I totally agree with you. I do the exact same thing you said.
Thank you so much. If any of our listeners do the exact same thing or have tips as to how we can improve our explanations, please feel free to share. Adriana said that keywords, terminology has to be explicit, explained using various sentences and phrases to further understand, visuals and retrieval questions to further understand and check in deep knowledge. What tips would you give, Zach, to use explicit and direct instruction for, you know, teaching children about terminology or keywords when it comes to literacy?
This one is a tip that came from first to me by Daisy Christodoulou, but also I think it's really been supported by Adam Boxer, who you've already mentioned. What you would do with vocabulary words is start with an example of what it is. So if you're teaching about for example, the word quill, and that could be a porcupine spine, or that could be a type with a feather, right? You start by showing a picture of it, or you start by saying, this is a quill, and drawing it, or you say, this is a quill, and then you follow that with your definition or your explanation. I feel like starting with the concrete bit when it comes to the terminology, what it does is it arms them with prior knowledge of what it is. They go, aha, I know what that is now. I see a picture of it. Yeah. You've given me an example. Now I'm sort of prepared to hear the more abstract version of it, which is the definition or the explanation. Teachers just go with the definition right off the bat. And they never give examples and non-examples. And so students are sort of left with, I don't really understand the definition in the first place because there's a lot of words in it I don't understand. And so they never really come to learn the term.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that, especially with what you mentioned about the concrete examples. And I guess it's a bit of dual coding and the fact that there's a saying that says, you know, a picture speaks a thousand words. So pairing explanations or keyword with a picture does a lot for students' understanding. Michelle has another question for you. She said, what do you think about teachers pay teachers? It's a time-saving hack for teachers to create lesson plans. However, some would argue it's an unjust outsourcing of the state's fiscal policy and responsibility to provide a detailed curriculum and materials. What do you think? I'm presuming this is, Michelle, you're from the US, because some of this doesn't make sense to me. I'm based in the UK.
Well, Teachers Pay Teachers is it's just another website. There's many of them, many different websites where you either pay or you can get a sample to get some resources. Uh-huh. And some of these were made by teachers. So it was kind of cool maybe in the early days where we were like, oh, we're kind of all supporting each other. We're buying each other's materials. But I totally agree with the second part of the comment, which is that I don't think that is a way to run an education system. Mm-hmm. If we take the example of phonics again, there are now a handful of phonics programs that are very successful. And if they're not really empirically based, I know from having used them that if you use them with fidelity with a few tweaks, you can teach phonics very, very quickly. And the cost of these materials seems extravagant from an individual standpoint, but a lot of times these school budgets are they'll throw money at these materials and then they'll leave them to collect dust and they'll replace them within a few years. So clearly, at least in our context, there's money for these materials. They just don't keep them for very long. They don't train the teachers on them for very long. I'm on the side of this argument that structured materials created by someone else, an instructional designer or a team of teachers at the school who are using instructional design principles is way better than every teacher spending their evenings Googling and going on Pinterest trying to figure out what they're going to teach and then using their own money to buy pretty substandard materials. I think that's just absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And also in terms of resources, sometimes what I found is especially in a department where we are collaboratively planning, what I find is that if I'm using high quality resources that maybe somebody in my department has planned, it allows me to just simply focus, okay, what questions am I going to pose? How am I going to explain this concept? So there's pros and cons in on both sides, I think. But going back to explanations, what should CPD look like in order to improve teacher explanations, do you think?
Well, we could start by somebody actually mentioning that they're important.
That's a good point. Very good point. Yeah.
We should start with that because explanations are almost, they're almost all of what people think of when it comes to teaching. It's kind of funny if you asked someone on the street, like, tell me about a teacher who really taught you a lot of material, not the fun one, not the entertaining one, but the one who really you know, taught you some stuff, they would say that they explained it so well. Yeah. They will remember, I don't understand how this person was able to explain that material in such a way. It was like they were born to be a teacher. And wow. So if we could just focus in on practicing our explanations, rehearsing them. I use a lot of video in my instructional coaching. And at first, people are not really comfortable with video sometimes. But yeah. What you get to do if you're by yourself watching a video that nobody else has access to is you get to sort of confront the fact that maybe your explanation is a little confusing to people, that maybe that you're teaching too slowly, you're rambling, you're using a lot of ums and ahs, that part of your explanation should have been cut, you could have trimmed it down halfway, and so on. So using video, using our planning time better to actually focus on the meat of the lesson, which is asking questions and explaining stuff.
Yeah.
And then really thinking about those other components that are related to explanations, like the gradual release of responsibility, like checking for understanding. How is explanation integrated in a full teaching system in a way that sets kids up to be successful and doesn't sort of overwhelm them, overload them, or confuse them?
Definitely agree with that, especially about what you just said about looking back up at the most effective teachers or our favorite teachers. And my favorite teacher was a history teacher. And I remember, several history teachers. And I just remember one history teacher in particular in secondary school. I don't remember any fancy task. We never did group work, but his storytelling just made history come alive. And that's how I fell in love. One of the reasons why I fell in love with history, because of the stories, because of those explanations. It just, you know, always left me on a hook. And I just remember running to his lessons because I want to know the next part of the story. So you're right in terms of that. And it's something that I'm even just trying to perfect and improve as a teacher, as a teacher talk radio host. My explanations, I just remember listening back to one of the shows that I recently did, and I just remember I said a lot of ums. And it's not until we really look back and we reflect and listen back or watch back our explanations, we hear and we see those patterns within the explanations that might make it mazy or vague. So yeah, I definitely agree with that.
And for me, I'm sort of in a similar position as you. For me, it was that I kept adding an extra sentence to an already perfect explanation, right? I was always given an extra little bit to finish it off. And I realized if I just ended right on the high point of that explanation, it would be so much faster and easier to understand. So I agree with you.
Thank you. I do have a next question in regards to the science of learning. So I know that you do a lot in terms of the science of learning. Can you talk to me about the science of learning and how the science of learning can improve our practice?
Well, for me, the science of learning, all it means is that we use objective evidence to inform our practice. And a lot of the science of learning coming from cognitive science or the science of behavior is really understanding some of the key ideas that allow us to make predictions in the classroom, allow us to not be sort of teaching at random, but actually teaching in a systematic way where if I do these few things, these sort of best bets, it's gonna lead to something good, especially compared to something else. So examples include, for example, in retrieval practice, I know that if I maybe start my lesson with a do now, or throughout my lesson, make sure I pause and have students do a brain dump or write down two things about what we learned yesterday, that I'm going to be activating, I'm going to be harnessing the testing effect. I'm going to be actually getting them to use active cognition in their learning. So when I talk about the science of learning, I divide it into different buckets. And I will do presentations that really take deep dives into cognitive load theory, into generative learning, into feedback and formative assessment. And I find teachers really find it to be a relief in a lot of ways to hear, because it's what a lot of people already do or associate. It's not some sort of magical innovation. It's we're focusing on attention. We're focusing on cognitive load. We're focusing on practice and what makes effective practice. And for teachers, I think that's what they want out of PD. They don't want all this other stuff that's more focused in on what's the latest fad or the latest trend. They want to talk about learning and teaching.
Yeah, definitely agree. And how to maximize outcomes for students. What do you think of the barriers to implementing the science of learning principles in schools?
Well, I think a lot of teachers have been told or they've been sold a story that each of us should be on our own island. We shouldn't be working together. We should teach our own lessons. And then at the end of the day, everyone sort of fends for themselves. And I don't know what he would frame it that way, but that's a lot of the attitude I've experienced with spreading the news around anything that is effective. But, you know, so I think teachers need to work together as a team. And some schools have that ethos. We all work together as a team. We have standardized transitions in the corridors. We have lessons that are explicit, and we use common formative assessments and so on. And especially I feel like in the U.S., it's just like a free-for-all in some schools. Everybody does what they want to do. So if I come in as a consultant and start talking about cognitive load theory, explicit instruction, dual coding, they will sit there and they will listen to it. And maybe it's interesting. They like the stories. They like the images. Mm-hmm. And maybe each of them will connect to one or two things. But unless they're all working together, the teachers, towards furthering student learning around a specific instructional model that is basically explicit instruction and classroom management, there's going to be some barriers there. It might just be interesting for some people and not really useful for other people.
Thank you, Zach. Welcome to Miss Hadley, and thank you to our listeners that have been with us at the beginning. I know we've only got about 5 minutes left. I do have two more questions before we end. What are your views around learning objectives and or success criteria? There's been a lot of talk on Twitter or X recently around that. So what are your views around learning objectives or success criteria? Do you think it helps learning? Do you think it's a waste of time? What are your views?
I like you taught me, like, wasn't I like ranting about that for like 5 days? But basically, like, a lot of this stuff, and all teachers will acknowledge this, a lot of these different things you need to put on your board are meant to help direct the attention of an evaluator who comes into your classroom, your principal, your head of school, right? So that we want to post them so that they know what to ask the children, like, what are you learning about? And they get a specific answer, right? Yeah. And so what I see in a lot of classrooms is the misuse of these learning objectives and success criteria, where they put up this huge board showing all of these different statements, the standards, SB 31 and SB 32, and they're connecting to all of these curriculum documents. But these curriculum documents should be on paper, right? They do not occupy the entire space of your board. And what happens is the lessons begin with this long drawn out thing of, here is the learning target, here is the success criteria, here are the standards we're hitting, here's the assessment you're going to do. By the time you get 8-9 minutes into this stuff, the children are bored to tears, first of all, and they weren't really listening because this language is abstract for them.
I agree.
You could narrow this down in almost every circumstance to a single sentence. Hey guys, remember how we're learning about division today? Let's get going. And you go up on the board and you start talking about what they're learning through an example that is on the board, that is concrete. And then you're asking questions, and the principal would come in at that point and see, oh, I know what they're learning. All the children can tell me what they're learning because the teacher is teaching, right? They're not going through these very strange kind of, jumping through these hoops and saying all this formal language that doesn't really help the kids with their learning. So that's why I went on the rant about it. It's not that I don't think that every lesson should have a clear objective or that the children should not know what they're expected to do. That's exactly how the teacher should start their lesson. Just some of the maybe what we would call lethal mutations around some of these more administrative aspects of teaching. I think those can be avoided.
Same. I definitely agree with you. And especially in my subject, which is history, I'm not a big fan of success criteria, nor am I a big fan of learning objectives. I don't really feel it benefits the students whatsoever. It's there for the observer, just as you mentioned. So what actually benefits the students more, as well as myself in planning, is having a big question. So, for example, what was the biggest factor in the lead up to World War One? Or what I talked recently. My head's gone blank. But yeah, having a big question, and if they could answer that big question by the end of the lesson, then that objective has been achieved. And I think that posing a learning objective in the form of a big question is much more beneficial for students because they understand it more, and it just makes it, yeah, just it simplifies it for their understanding.
I find that especially true in history and in science. Two areas I work with teachers, they understand or appreciate the encouragement to maybe change a measurable objective to a question objective. But then a lot of times, since I do teach math, I always go to bat for the math people. A lot of times we try to get them to remember a small piece of a procedure. And if by the end of the day, they can execute that on their mini whiteboards 100% of the time, we've met our objective. And so asking a question about it just is a little awkward, but I totally agree.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. I don't know how that would translate well in other subjects like DT or maths and so on. My final question, because I know you have to go, is around you've obviously have a lot of experience in terms of America. What would you say is the similarities and the differences of the American and the UK education landscape? Do you think one's more advanced or one's catching up? What are your views on the education landscape in both places? Because I don't really have a clue on the American educational landscape, so it's all new to me.
And I didn't know anything about it until I got on Twitter, like in 2012, right? I honestly wouldn't have known that it was important to learn from other systems, and I wouldn't have known how often things could be lost in translation between English-speaking countries. From what I can tell, and I've had many, many, many guests from England and the UK and Ireland and Australia and so on, different English-speaking countries on my various things. One of the main differences that I think England has been a pioneer in are things like research ed, prioritizing classroom management and behavior. Some of the more innovative schools, you can call them innovative or you can dislike them, but schools that are sort of famous right now for in the United Kingdom, we don't seem to have a version of those over the United States where, you know, silent corridors and students are all tracking the speaker and so on. There's been if I could sum it up for myself, it's that you have focused on the three buckets that we started off talking about: curriculum, behavior, and instruction. And to wrap it up with a bow, you focused on cognitive science and having conferences like research, forward thinking. And I don't think we have any of that going on here to the same degree. That being said, we have research ed Greenwich. It's our Greenwich in Connecticut. And we have research ed Delaware coming up. So maybe the United States is starting to take your lead and pick it up.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I do find that since 2015, the UK has become much more research informed. I'm actually taking a bit of a secondment and working in Dubai, and it's not as research informed. It's very kind of performative learning, lots of group work, making learning fun and engagement driven, but not necessarily learning driven. And that's because of a whole majority of the schools are private and therefore we need to make the clients happy, and therefore engagement's more of a priority than generative, hard thinking learning tasks to some extent. Not all schools, but some schools definitely would say I can't paint the same brush for all schools, but that's what I'm kind of noticing in the UAE. So hopefully there will be a worldwide revolution in terms of research and research informed practice. I'm hoping for. Thank you so much, Zach, for joining us today. Before we wrap up today's episode, let's take a moment to recap the key points we've uncovered with Zach. We've had an enlightening conversation around explicit and direct instruction, and I wanted to highlight some of the most important insights that you shared. So, for example, explicit and direct instruction isn't all teacher-led. In order to secure students' understanding, our explanations need to be punchy and pacey. We need to ensure that we're doing regular checks for listening and regular checks for understanding. Using DI or explicit instruction methods does not take away from students' independence at all. In fact, it enables students to eventually become independent through the use of scaffolding new material chunk by chunk. Is there anything else? Those were the things that were very much highlighted to me. Is there anything else anybody wants to add as a summary of what Zach has highlighted in today's show? If so, please do continue on in the conversation by tweeting us at Teacher Talk Radio or myself or Zach. I thank you so much, Zach, for joining us. You've been amazing, and you've also enlightened me in terms of my understanding around teacher explanations as well as explicit and direct instruction. So that wraps up our conversation for today. A huge thank you to our guests, Zach, as I mentioned, for sharing your expertise with us. And to our listeners, I hope you found today episode informative and thought-provoking. Be sure to subscribe to Teacher Talk Radio for more discussions like this one. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to share it with your colleagues who might also be interested in today's discussion. That's all for today. Until next time, I'm Emily from the Rent Show, signing off. Take care, everyone. Bye.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.